Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with me now is Allison Dahl Crossley, Associate Director of the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University, and the author now of Finding Feminism, Millennial Activists and the Unfinished Gender Revolution. Welcome to WNYC. Professor Crossley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you look at the millennial feminist experience in particular by using extensive survey research and interview data on the feminist collectives at the University of Minnesota, University of California, Santa Barbara, and Smith College. What were you looking for?
Well, you know, I noticed there was so much misinformation and contradictory information about young feminists today. Is feminism dead? Is it alive? Are we in a post-feminist era? Are millennials clueless to the inequalities around them? And when I looked at gender research, there was really very little empirical research to examine these questions. So I went to these different college campuses. I spent time with a feminist. I talked with them about what kind of feminist organizing they were doing and what feminism meant to them. I participated and observed in their organizations and their meetings. And I found a really complex and nuanced portrait of feminism today on college campuses.
Does the term fourth wave feminism have currency on campuses today?
You know, it's a good question, and I didn't find interest in the wave framework among my participants. I was a little bit surprised by that. Very few people were interested in being lumped together in a particular wave at all. They didn't want to feel like there were certain values or ideologies of a wave foisted upon them. They wanted to do feminism their own way.
So, for example, one of your chapters is Multicultural Sororities, Women Centers, and the Institutional Fields of Feminist Activism. Are there a lot of multicultural sororities that you found? I think fraternities and sororities historically tend to be pretty racially segregated.
Yeah, exactly. And when I was looking for the different feminist organizations on each campus and kind of surveying the landscape of the feminist organization on campuses, I found a lot of women of color engaging in some really interesting feminist activism in these multicultural sororities, which are, in my research, were African-American sororities as well as Chicana and Latina sororities. And what's interesting about that is, in general, research shows that women of color are typically more likely to embrace feminism than white women, specifically Black and Latina women. And in my survey, I found a similar phenomenon. And I did find in these multicultural sororities that they did feminism in a little bit of a different way than in some of the more predominantly white organizations. They were focused on building a community of women of color. They were focused on lifting up younger generations, say high school students who had similar backgrounds and racial identities to themselves, and encouraging them to go to college. And so their feminism was a little bit more community focused and was a little bit more focused on perpetuating the next generation of women of color feminists.
Your first chapter is called Where Have All the Feminists Gone? Millennials and the Unfinished Gender Revolution. And I see you categorize the participants in your study as feminist, non-feminist, and fence sitters. How much of a sort of mandatory word, how much of a dirty word, how much in between is the word feminist on the college campuses you studied?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think there's this perception that there's this big stigma around feminist identities, and that has been pretty continuous over the past 30 or 40 years. But in fact, we know that 30 to 40% of the population typically identifies as a feminist in general. So I think the reality of feminist identities and the stigma are not necessarily matching up. I think in my research, I found that there was a lot of interest in feminists and feminism and millennials. They were not so hung up on worrying about what it meant if they were to embrace a certain identity. But that said, feminism, I think, is on a spectrum, right? Feminism is heterogeneous. It differs by context. Some people identified very strongly as a feminist, and it was critical to their everyday lives and to their activism and their relationships. Other people felt like, yeah, it was part of them, but it wasn't necessarily something that they lived and died by. And those were more kind of the fence sitters, right? And I think it speaks to the success of of the feminist movement to some degree, that there is this spectrum of feminism, right? That it's okay to do it or to embrace it in different ways and to think about feminism in complex and nuanced ways, you know, because people experience inequalities differently. Women experience, you know, being women in the world differently. So they're going to organize against those inequalities differently.
Who are the fence sitters demographically?
Well, the fence sitters were a little bit more on the end of the white feminists in my study, right? They were some of the people who I think had a little more of a privilege to deny that inequality existed or shaped their lives. I think that they were the type of women that felt like, you know, I really can do whatever I want, and I believe in this kind of girl power narrative, so I don't necessarily need to go all the way to identify as a feminist, but I don't want to go so far as to say I'm not a feminist.
Many women you interviewed spoke about how their mothers had expansive hopes for them as their daughters and their futures, wanting them to focus on their education and careers, but at the same time modeling in their own lives, these moms, the domestic gendered division of labor that was more traditional. What impact did that have on your participants' experience of feminism?
Oh, it was a huge impact. And those are some of the interviews that are just etched in my mind. Those experiences of these young women and these girls being told both from their mothers, from their fathers, and from culture at large that they can be whatever they want, right? That, you know, you can get to the White House, you can do anything you want, you know, there are no limits upon you as a woman. Yet when they observed their relationships around them, when they observed treatment of women in the media, and when they just experienced being a woman in the world, they realized that this wasn't necessarily the case and that there were some important structural barriers, racism, sexism, etc., that were going to affect their lives. And that tension really, in some cases, really motivated them and fueled their activism, but I think was also frustrating and confusing and saddening.
You know, it would be interesting to take some phone calls on that question, I think. So let's open up the phones for a few minutes. Let's say just for women under 30, if you were raised being told by maybe your feminist mom, you can be anything you want to be in this world, we're raising you to shatter any remaining glass ceilings. If that sounds like the way you were raised, then has that been your experience? Have you had some rude awakenings, either when you got to college or when you got out of college? You heard what our guest was just saying. What story about yourself might you want to tell along these lines, anywhere on that spectrum? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or how do you see your own parents in that regard? Did you have parents who were telling you, you know, go focus on your education, go focus on your career, be equal, expect your future husband, if you have a heterosexual marriage, to do 50% of the child care, but they weren't living that way? And how did you process that growing up and as you started to become an adult? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Alison Dahl Crossley from Stanford University, author now of Finding Feminism, Millennial Activists and the Unfinished Gender Revolution. And we'll continue with Professor Crossley and take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and with Alison Dahl Crossley, author of Finding Feminism, Millennial Activists and the Unfinished Gender Revolution. Marie in Hempstead, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I just want to say that I'm living in New York now, but I grew up out west, and we were never told that we were feminists or that we could do anything a man could do. We were just expected to do it. We were expected to bale hay, shoe horses, herd cattle, do whatever we needed to do that a man was doing, and we were never told that we were being feminist. It was just a mindset that anything a man was doing, we could do it, and it was just a different way of thinking, I guess.
And now you live on Long Island, so I presume you're not in farming. If I can ask what you did grow up to do professionally, and kind of how those life lessons growing up in the way that you did apply, how do they apply?
Well, I'm a teacher now. I'm a teacher and an adjunct professor, but I think it just instilled in me a sense of just respect for men, respect for women, or just respect for people, and to be able to approach a job or people and do whatever needs to be done.
Marie, thanks so much. And we're going to go to Nicole in Manhattan. Nicole, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You have a story to tell?
I do. So when I'm actually a full-time tenured professor at a local university, and when I got pregnant, I called and said, okay, I'd like to learn about the maternity leave. And they said, well, there is no such thing. You can take the Family Medical Leave Act, but first you have to use your sick time in order to have the baby. And I said, well, I'm not sick, I'm pregnant. And she said, well, we consider it a sickness. You need to take 6 weeks of your sick time, and then you can go on to the Family Medical Leave Act. And I said, okay, well, I have 5 months of sick time banked for over 10 years, so I'd like to use all my sick time. And she said, well, you can't. And I said, well, why not? And she said, because you're not sick. And I said, I don't understand. You're forcing me to use my sick time.
It's catch 22.
And then you're not allowing me to use it.
Yeah.
And then she said, yeah. But more than that, what surprised me was that there's a lot of other moms I know are in very tight situations with things like maternity leave, but people don't really seem that bothered by it. Like, I was just beside myself, so frustrated and angry. But a lot of women, I think they just sort of get used to having to deal with these things, and so they don't even really acknowledge them as obstacles when, in fact, they are.
Nicole, thank you very much. Maria in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maria.
Hi.
Sorry,
it's nice to call in. So I wanted to call in because, did you want to start with the
question? No, you go. No, you wanted to call in because that's what I want to hear.
No, because I think that, I think Facebook feminism is really interesting. I think I went to Wellesley, and that was really nice because we talked about feminism a lot. And one of the really uncomfortable conversations that comes up is about specifically around white women feminism and how that shuts out women who are more women of other races for, you know, what sort of your speaker was talking about, which is when you come from privilege, it's difficult to see feminism within. You sort of have tunnel vision when it comes to looking at issues. And I thought that was really interesting. And I wanted to sort of, you know, chime in because I did grow up thinking, you know, I was raised primarily by my mother, and she was very big on feminism, very big on you could do whatever you wanted, and going to Wellesley, you definitely get exposed to feminism much more. But I do think that nowadays we do see sort of this, you know, Facebook feminism, which is like you're signing up online, you're arguing online, but what are you really doing in practice, I guess? And what does it mean? How do you transcend
Professor,
social media, I guess?
Professor Crossley, you're relating to that?
Yeah, certainly. I think online feminism and Facebook feminism, I think it can be a question about what is the meaning of that and how activist is it really. But in my research about online feminism, I found that it was critical to the perpetuation of a movement because feminists learned about the history of the movement. They learned feminist perspectives on current events. They connected with other feminists in different parts of the country. It allowed them to enhance their feminism and to deepen their feminism in a way that they didn't necessarily get offline. So I think it can also be seen as a complement to online feminism, to offline feminism.
Maria.
Do you think, like, on Facebook, because we're also segmented, you know, you only see what people who are in your social group post, it leads to even more, you know, what we see now, which is you read stories that go viral in your particular bubble, and you don't know anything about the people outside of that. So if you happen to have a very homogeneous bubble, you sort of get locked out of the feminist or any other perspective of outside of that.
Oh, certainly. I think that's a real risk, and I think that's a really good point. And I think that's kind of a call to have responsibility to seek out feminist media, to seek out a diverse form of media in your day-to-day media consumption. It's really important.
Maria, thanks so much for your call. Can I ask how things are at Stanford? I mean, you know, the election was such a shock for so many people, and yet so many millennial women in this country were not enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton, which might have contributed to her defeat in some states. So how did you see, you know, this is not, I mean, you did specific research for your book, but you're also a professor at Stanford. I'm just curious how you saw the pre-election period kind of in these millennial feminist terms and the post-election period.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a really hopeful and exciting time before the election. And I think there was a lot of really, you know, a lot of really great positive energy and hope for change among young people. And I think it was just a shocker. And I think it was a wake up call to many people, especially students, that, you know, change is not inevitable. Progress is not inevitable. It requires organizing. It requires everyday activism. It requires protests. It requires standing up for what you believe in. And in that sense, it's really exciting to see what will happen next and to see that energy and to think about how we can support it as administrators at a school and working with students every day.
Andrea in Oldwick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Andrea.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I was born in Budapest. My family is Hungarian, and we came to the United States in 1960 after having left Russian-occupied Budapest in 58, not in 56. And my mother was a physician, and she, you know, she studied in Budapest, and then she became a physician here in the United States. And so she was one of the first physicians. She was one of the, I shouldn't say first, but one of only a few.
And so how does it relate to the conversation now, just to get to the point, because we're running out of time?
That I was raised with a mother who was a doctor, and that was extremely rare, let alone someone who was one of the only doctors allowed into medical school back in the 40s.
And so how did it influence who you became?
She was a fantastic role model, and the issue of feminism just never came up because, like one of your previous callers said, it was the status quo. There was a woman who was a physician, and at a time when it was not nearly as common as it is now. And so that is, if she could do anything, I could do anything. And my father always encouraged my brother and me to be whatever we wanted, and he wanted me to become a diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
It was no different than had I been a boy. I mean, it was just, this is the way the world is. You can be whatever you want.
And Andrew, we're going to leave it there. Forgive me, just because we're running out of time, I'm going to sneak in one more phone call. Liz in Westchester, can you do it in about 30 seconds? Liz, hi.
Yes, I can. Hi, Brian. As a feminist raised in the 50s and only having one child, a son, I felt it was a responsibility to raise him, he's a millennial, to learn how to look at his role as a father and as a young man and not be held back by traditional gender roles.
So now that he's a grown-up, did it work?
He learned how to do laundry, and as a father now, he accepts a great deal of responsibility, and he and his wife share child rearing and household chores, and I'm very proud of that.
Thank you very much. Professor Crosley, in our last minute or so, what do you see as sort of the tension line for the immediate future? You know, is it around Trump? Is it conversations feminists are having with each other? Is it the racial question? Is it censorship on campus and, you know, whether the Ann Coulters of the world should be allowed to speak or resisted from even hearing their point of view? What's kind of the main fault line right now?
I think it is related to Trump, and I think now is the time when feminism and feminists need to be okay that we don't all agree on everything, that there are feminisms and multiple forms of feminism and different ways of working to change gender inequality and other interrelated inequalities, and we need to be okay with that and move forward. And not to minimize tensions in the movement and problems in the movement, but I think the heterogeneity of it is actually a benefit to it, right? Because because we have organizations at different levels, community organizations, national organizations, grassroots organizations, all different types of groups working together and working separately, all in the same spirit to advance the movement and advance equality. And I think now's the time to really support any way, any type of organization, any community group that you think is going to help move us in the right direction.
Allison Dahl Crossley is Associate Director of the Michelle Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University, and her new book is Finding Feminism, Millennial Activists, and the Unfinished Gender Revolution. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And have a great weekend, everyone. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.